From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Father John Trigilio. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
A tremendous Monday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. Father John Trigilio is in the house from the Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland. If you'd like to be part of the program, the number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd still love to hear from you. That number is 1-205-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email. That email address is openline@ewtn.com. Excuse me. And you can text your question to Father Trigilio. Text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. I'm Jack Williams, Michael McCall producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Kubensky and Ace McKay handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window, and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, as he is every Monday, Father John Trigilio, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
We had Lisa, who was hanging on at the end of the last program, and her question was, she had visited her parents' parish, and they had a layperson do the preaching at Mass, and she wants to know if that's kosher.
No. Absolutely forbidden. Now, here's the distinction. Only the priest or deacon, or obviously bishop, that is someone who's received holy orders, is allowed to preach the homily. The homily is the sermon that's given immediately after the gospel at Mass. So if there is someone going to give a little reflection, or, you know, sometimes we have guys who are up for diaconate, so they want to get practice, and some of the dioceses allow this. But they can only do that at the end of Mass, or right after the Eucharist, or the closing prayer of the Mass before the final blessing. But they're not allowed to say or give their talk right after the gospel, because people would misinterpret that as if it were a homily. So if someone's going to give a talk, and sometimes they have religious sisters or nuns give a talk on the missions or whatever, or a layperson, but unless you're a priest, deacon, or bishop, you cannot give the liturgical sermon immediately after the gospel at Mass. And now, lay people are authorized to preach, but not at Mass. They can give a talk, a fervorino, in other contexts, but not at Mass. So if that's what's going on here, it is forbidden.
And I think we see also a lot of times, if there's going to be a parish mission at the Masses on the weekend prior to the mission, if it's being led by a layperson, you'll see, as you described, that talk before the final blessing, after distribution of Holy Communion and before the final blessing, that's a whole different animal.
Oh, absolutely. And because when I was a pastor, I had a missionary coming, and normally you get a priest who then you say, well, Father, you can have the Mass. But this was a brother. He was not a deacon. He was not a priest. He was a brother. And so he had to give the talk at the end, just right after the closing prayer, but before the final blessing.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. It's a free phone call. We got wide open phone lines for you at the beginning of the program here. 833-288-3986. Mark writes in, what happens to the soul when somebody goes to communion with mortal sin?
Ooh. With mortal sin, and you go to communion, you committed the sin of sacrilege, so now you're in more jeopardy. No graces are being communicated to you because of the fact that your mortal sin, in a sense, locks the door. It's like your house is locked, and you're the one who has locked it from the inside, and you're blocking God's grace, so you need to go to confession. So you commit a sin, which is now another sin, besides the previous mortal sin that you didn't get confessed, and no graces are available to you until you get that's both sins. Now you have to confess the mortal sin and the new mortal sin of receiving communion sacrilegiously.
David wants to know if God the Father died when Jesus died.
God the Father could not die, and even God the Son did not die. His human nature died. Remember, Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. In his Godhead, in his divine personhood, he could not die, but his human nature died. He had a human soul, with a human intellect, human will, and then he had a divine soul, which is the divine intellect and the divine will. So God the Father, there's a lot of theological speculation on did the Father feel sadness at the death of the Son. Well, that's a little bit anthropomorphism, giving human attributes to divinity, and yet we know that that was a sacrifice. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. So there is a sense that the Father didn't make a sacrifice, and yet there's no way that God himself would have died, nor did Jesus in his divinity die.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. It is a free telephone call anywhere in the United States and Canada. Pick up the phone and give us a call. 833-288-3986. Ed wants to know, what makes certain saints incorruptible? Why them and not others?
We don't know. That's the easy answer. It's God's will who has this particular gift, and it's not all the saints, obviously. Certain saints just have it, like Saint Bernadette Soubirous, other saints, Saint Catherine of Siena, and there are many, many saints who have the gift of incorruptibility, but that is not in and of itself a constitutive element for canonization. It certainly adds to the case, but they need a full-blown miracle that takes place through the intercession of that saint. And so if they find that the saint is intact, that certainly gives them credence to continue the investigation. But other saints that they've exhumed, decomposed, that doesn't mean that they ended up in the bad place or that they're still in purgatory. So incorruptibility is like the gift of stigmata. Padre Pio had it, St. Francis of Assisi had it, but the saints who did not have it didn't detract from their holiness.
And there are varying degrees of incorruptibility also, right?
I mean, yeah, some of them, there's still flesh on their bone, so to speak, but, the skin has gotten dark and sometimes almost coal black, a little wrinkly, but they're not mummified. That's the thing, is that it's unlike the Egyptians who did a process of mummification. These saints who they've exhumed should have been either completely dust or at least just a skeleton, and there's still some flesh left on their skeleton. So they're not pristine, and sometimes they put a little coating of wax just to preserve, so that further decay does or the skin doesn't come completely off. But the fact that there's flesh there is the miracle.
Yeah, Bernadette looks like she's taking a nap, for crying out loud.
Oh, it's so peaceful, yes.
Oh, goodness gracious. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. What was the Catholic response to the Protestant Reformation? John wants to know. You got 2 minutes, go.
Well, the Counter-Reformation, the Council of Trent was the response to the Protestant Reformation, to address all the things that Martin Luther, Zwingli, Huss, and the other Protestant reformers had complained about, and certainly so the Council of Trent, the establishment of seminaries, and then what they called the Counter-Reformation, and people like St. Charles Borromeo and that spearheaded that. So that instigated and spurred on an even more zealous defense and spreading of the faith.
Yeah, I mean, these discussions had already started when the 95 Theses were, right?
Yeah, they were not. Yeah. This was not out of the blue, and there were abuses, but not by the church herself, by members of the church. Just like we have today, you know, you have individuals causing scandal, and scandal has not been, you know, immune to the church. I mean, look, you had Judas, one of the 12 apostles, betrayed Christ. Peter, the first pope, denied him three times. Thomas doubted him. So we've had incidents throughout church history, but the church as a whole is indefectible. She is the spotless bride of Christ, but it's the members who can misbehave, and from the top on down.
Straight ahead, we'll talk to Kirsty in Bowling Green, Kentucky, Bill in Harrisburg, PA, and we've got plenty of time for your phone calls. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's Open Line Monday with Father John Trigilio.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
All right, I'm going to tell you about something that is, this is so cool. I really, really, really encourage you to just go check this out online, even if you don't intend to purchase one. Just go check it out online because it's a really cool thing. It's called our Blessed is the Nation Rosary for America. In 1846, the bishops of the United States adopted a decree by which they chose the Blessed Virgin Mary, conceived without sin, as the patroness of the United States. For more than 150 years, Catholics in America have placed their lives, hopes, dreams, and concerns under this special patronage of the Mother of God. You can pray for our nation with this unique metal rosary from Gorelli, featuring a specific crucifix with red and blue enamel stars and stripes on the front and One Nation Under God on the back. And on the center is an image of Our Lady on the map of the United States of America with Psalm 33:12 on the back that reads, "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord." And each, this is the cool part, the coolest part, I think. Each of the 50 Hail Mary beads has a different state's individual abbreviation on it. So praying one decade of the rosary gives you intercession for every state in the union. This very special rosary is imported from Italy, and it's available now at EWTNRC.com. They're offering free standard shipping on online orders of $75 or more. Standard shipping in the continental U.S. only. Use the code FREE at checkout. As advertised, first up today is Kirsty in Bowling Green, Kentucky, listening to EWTN on the Savior Radio Network. Kirsty, you're on with Father John. Kirsty, are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Okay, what's your question today?
Why is David a man of God's very own heart and none of the other prophets or people of the Bible?
So why is David the only one, Father, that's described as a man after God's own heart?
Okay, it's certainly a metaphor, but it means that King David was so close to the Lord, but only when he was in the state of grace, because obviously we know he committed the sin of adultery, and then he was also, committed the sin of murder when he had Uriah dispatched because he was in love with his wife. But King David, as opposed to Saul, Saul was a legitimate king, and he was chosen by God. But David was after God's heart. We see that especially when he was composing the Psalms. And when David was good, he was very good. And, God's heart is merciful. God's heart is just. And so that way, King David ruled as God himself wanted him. But when he misbehaved, he did it big time. And he suffered the consequences for that. So it doesn't mean that anybody else was not close to God, but he gets that special moniker of having God's heart. And again, it's a figure of speech, but it's a very high compliment.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. That's the number Anna used in Houston, Texas, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Anna, you're on with Father John Trigilio.
Hi. What I want to know is if a person is not in a state of grace when they receive their first communion or when they receive confirmation, you said earlier that it locks the door to grace. So if a person is in a state of mortal sin when they receive confirmation or first communion, and then later they go to confession, will they then receive the grace of confirmation?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And the Council of Trent made that very clear, that the validity of the sacrament is not contingent on the spiritual state of the recipient. So if somebody, for instance, if a bride and groom are in the state of mortal sin, they're validly married. If they get married the in sin, but the graces are sort of held up in a holding pattern until they go to confession and then have that mortal sin removed. Then, again, like we mentioned before, not only would they have had the mortal sin prior to the being married, but then the sacrilege of receiving the sacrament in the state of sin. And likewise, if somebody was in mortal sin and got confirmed, where they were in mortal sin, they got ordained. These are instances where it's still validly conferred. The person is truly receiving the sacrament, but the graces that are available are what's held up until now. That's why we encourage the children, and canon law requires them to receive first confession before first communion, so that they realize that there's that intimate connection between being in the state of grace and receiving the sacraments. But it's not for validity's sake, because the sacraments operate ex opere operato, which is the Latin way of saying is by the work itself, as opposed to ex opere operantis, which is contingent upon the person's spiritual state. So, for instance, if I pray a rosary and I'm in the state of mortal sin, there's no graces being available at all because of my state. But if I receive a sacrament, it's valid if I'm in mortal sin, yet I need to go to confession to receive that sacramental grace that's available to me.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Heath is in Portageville, Missouri, listening on the Catholic Radio Network, a first-time caller. Heath, you're on with Father John Trigilio.
Hi, Father John. How are you?
Fine.
All right. My question is, going to confession and afterwards getting your penance, say it's a rosary, you pray the rosary, does it matter which rosary you pray? Here lately, after attending my crusade last November, I've been praying the rosary to St. Joseph. Would it matter which rosary I pray?
If you're referring to the chaplet of St. Joseph, it looks like a rosary, but it's technically not a rosary. The rosary is the one that St. Dominic, Blessed Virgin Mary, appeared to him, gave him the rosary. So when you're given the penance of a rosary, it means the traditional, typical rosary most people are aware of, or what they call the Dominican rosary. If you did not know that, and you prayed the St. Joseph chaplet, you did it in good faith, so you don't need to redo it. But in the future, when the priest gives you that penance to pray the rosary, they're talking about the one that everybody knows about. And yet there's like the Chaplet of Our Lady of Sorrows. It's directed to Our Lady and her intercession, but it's got seven beads as opposed to the ten because of the seven sorrows. It's technically not a rosary. You have the Chaplet of St. Francis of Assisi. You have all these other chaplets that look like rosaries, but when you get that penance, they're talking about what we customarily call the Dominican Rosary.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. They can pray whatever mysteries they want, though, right?
You can pray whatever mysteries, yes. I mean, you're not limited. Unless the priest says to you, I want you to pray the rosary on the particular like sorrowful mysteries. I may have done that once or twice in Lent, but usually I save that for someone who's mm-hmm. like religious, because like a religious nun or brother.
Bill is in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, listening on Holy Family Radio. Bill, you're on with Father John Trigilio.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. Father, I had a question, and really don't have a lot of knowledge, but I know something's transpired related to the traditional Latin Mass. And I was wondering if you could explain what Pope Benedict had changed and what Pope Francis had changed back, or however that worked. And then in particular, you know, how that might have impacted or is impacting the Fraternal Priestly Order of St. Peter, who I believe they are under the jurisdiction of the bishops, and how they're able or not able to ordain priests in that order.
Okay, well, I'm glad you called in from my my home diocese, Harrisburg. The Fraternity of St. Peter is a legitimate group of priests who came back into full union with the Catholic Church when Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre established the Society of Pius X, and then he illicitly consecrated bishops without the papal mandate. That caused a schism, and those bishops were not, you know, handpicked or chosen by the Holy Father, and that caused great disturbance in the church. The fraternity are those members, or afterwards, the priests who came into full communion with the Roman Catholic Church, and certainly accept the authority of the current reigning Roman Pontiff, which now is Pope Francis. Pope Benedict the 16th extended the privilege of celebrating what we call the extraordinary form, sometimes called the traditional Latin Mass, sometimes called the Mass of Pope Pius V, however you want to call it, to every single priest in the world was allowed to do that under Pope Benedict the 16th's indult. Pope Francis removed that, reduced it to only those members like with the Fraternity of St. Peter. There's also Institute of Christ the High Priest. These are specifically priests whose very existence is specifically only to celebrate. And so we have some Fraternity of St. Peter priests in the Diocese of Harrisburg. They're serving at the modern day chapel there in Harrisburg, which used to be St. Lawrence in the old days. Those priests will be ordained in the traditional rite. They can celebrate all the sacraments in the traditional rite. Some priests, like myself, we got authorized by Bishop Gaynor to be able to celebrate the extraordinary form, but only within the diocese and at the request of somebody. And then it can be limited to the local bishop and say, well, I only want this done in certain places. So Pope Francis has restricted what at one time was given a universal latitude. Pope Francis has reduced it, but he has not forbidden it per se. So anybody who goes to the Fraternity of St. Peter and their weekly Mass or even their daily Mass, or if you go to Institute of Christ the High Priest, that's legit. But you will not see it at a typical parish anymore. In the old days, just up until a few years ago when the old opprobrium came out, I used to celebrate the low Mass, which was extraordinary form, when I was a pastor up in Marysville. But now that's greatly restricted.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Open Line Monday with Father John Trigilio.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Congratulations going out to a long-time member of the EWTN Radio family, Catholic Radio Network, based in Kansas City. That's where they started, but they have 20 stations now in three states. and they're celebrating 20 years with EWTN. Congratulations to our good friends Jim and Carolyn O'Loughlin and their great team at Catholic Radio Network from all of your friends here at EWTN. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Carlos is in Dallas, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Carlos, you're on with Father John Trigilio.
Hey guys. Hi, Father. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. The first one is, what did Jesus mean on the cross when he said, "It is finished"? And number two, when I pray the rosary, I'll ask my guardian angel to contact the guardian angel of the person that I'm praying the rosary for. My guardian angel's never really told me, yeah, I can do that. So I'm wondering if that's possible.
Well, I'll answer the second one first. Padre Pio was a great advocate of having his guardian angel communicate with other people's guardian angels. So, and I am a strong devotee of St. Padre Pio. So, yes, I believe that can happen and does happen. So you can pray to your guardian angel and ask your guardian angel to pray for the guardian, ask the other person's guardian angel to intercede for them.
Will that be defined dogmatically at the Council of Harrisburg?
Probably. I think we're going to meet there sometime in the next 150 years or something like that. Now, the other question was, refresh my memory because I'm getting old now.
What was your first question, Carlos?
Thank you. The first question was, when Jesus was on the cross, the last thing he said was, "It is finished." What does that mean?
Okay, that's a very, very good question. In the Latin is consummatum est, it is finished, meaning the sacrifice has been completed. The Son offered up his life to the Father on behalf of the whole human race. And so as he's about to die, he says, "It is finished." His purpose on earth was to redeem us, and redemption took place at the moment of his death on Calvary on Good Friday. Salvation takes place the moment we actually get to heaven. Redemption took place on Good Friday. And so that phrase of Jesus on the cross, "It is finished," is what he's talking about. His life, yes, it's finished, but more importantly, the whole purpose of the Messiah, the Savior, took place at his death.
God bless you, Carlos. Thanks so much for the phone call today. 833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Mary is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, listening on Oklahoma Catholic Broadcasting. Mary, you're on with Father John Trigilio.
Hi, thank you for accepting my call. This is a kind of a different kind of question. It has to do with angels and the choirs and storms and holy water. Okay, that's the whole thing right there.
Okay.
So what my question is, well, what I do, I throw holy water on my car and where I live and all the cars that are in the parking lot in our where I live. And the reason I do that is because I've always believed that when the angels fell from heaven, those angels that sinned, the virtues were in charge of, like, weather. And so when they fell, you know, they want to create havoc. That's just what demons do, right? They just create havoc. It's not God who makes tornadoes and makes it happen. He allows it to happen. This is my understanding. He allows it to happen, but it's really all these other creatures, okay? So my question is, one, am I right on that? And two, is the purpose of holy water being thrown on all my stuff? Now, so far, we've been in the clear. I mean, even though we've had close to 100 tornadoes this season in Oklahoma, all around us, but it hasn't been actually in my city this time. But we've got storms coming up. I see all this grayness over there. So anyway, it's not stopping. So what do you think? Am I right on or am I not?
Okay, well, you're not far. You're not far. Certainly, yes, using holy water is a good thing to do, especially in preparation or in times of turmoil and tribulation. So, you know, in fact, lots of people have one of those old-fashioned crucifixes. When you open up, there's a little ball of holy water and some candles. That was traditionally used for when someone would bring communion to the sick, when the priest would come, they would light the candles and then use the holy water. But the holy waters and candles could also be used anytime there was like a storm coming, whether it's a hurricane or tornado or flood, to pray for a divine protection intervention. But it's not an absolute guarantee that it will not happen. You have to say, as Jesus said, you know, if it be possible, but your will be done, not mine. God's permissive will may be that, you know, you might, God forbid, you know, lose your house. It's not his ordained will per se, but it's his permissive will. So if a house is blessed and then it's destroyed, that's not an indication that somebody's in bad in a bad way with the Lord. But certainly the use of holy water, any of the sacramentals, rosary, miraculous medals, exercise salt, blessed candles, having palms in your house, especially after Palm Sunday, having a crucifix. Certainly, if not in every room, you should have one in your bedroom, and I would dare say you should have one in your living room as a sign of your of a profession of your faith. So yes, that is a good thing to do and maintain. The fact that some fallen angels are behind some of the storms, it's possible, yes, because as fallen angels, the demons do have some supernatural powers, but I would not want people to think that they are the only ones orchestrating. Some of the chaos in the universe is because of original sin, and we don't want to say it's only the devil and his minions who are up to this. So when there's an earthquake, a fire, or flood, it could just be the fact that there is disunity in the cosmos because of sin. Sin ruptured that harmony that existed in the Garden of Paradise. So whether a particular demon is behind all these things, I wouldn't necessarily want to go that far, but I do believe it is possible that demons can affect the weather. They can, you know, affect us, but they can never touch your free will. I think the most important thing is to pray to St. Michael the Archangel, to pray to Our Lady, St. Joseph, the terror of demons. That's one of his titles in the Litany of St. Joseph. Use holy water, get blessed candles, you know, certainly miraculous medals, wear the scapular, pray the rosary, and have a crucifix. Have your house blessed by a priest or deacon. Enthrone your family to the Sacred Heart. That's a wonderful thing to do. An epiphany, you know, have the blessed chalk or get the little printed up signs like we had in our parish put over your doorpost and that. But again, that in and of itself is not going to absolutely infallibly protect you from anything, but it's a good way of trusting and trusting God's mercy and providence.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Debbie is in Lebanon, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Debbie, you're on with Father John.
Father John, thank you. My question is kind of a roll-off of one of the previous callers. It just made me think when you talked about with the withholding of grace, if you are in mortal sin, but say you receive a sacrament, but you were in mortal sin and you still get the sacrament, but some grace is withheld. So on that note, my question is, I was married in the church. My husband was not Catholic at this time. And of course, I had at that time a mortal sin on my soul, of fornication, but he wasn't the Catholic, I was. And so I believe we received, you know, the grace of our marriage since we were in the Catholic Church when we were married. But I have never confessed that. And I just thought, yikes, maybe I should do that. My husband, so my question is that necessary? But my husband, darn him, converted later in life when we were about in our 30s. So he's free and clear from a lot of things. And anyway, just advice on that.
Okay, well, I would say first opportunity you get, please mention that in confession, because it's important that you know, you confess that you had a mortal sin that was not previously confessed. You are valley married in the eyes of God and the eyes of the church, so there's no doubt about that. You're married in church, and you, you know, as we call canonical form, you know, you said I do, and there was two witnesses, and the priest or deacon was there, and you intend to enter a permanent, faithful, and a fruitful union. That then that's all that will is necessary for it to be a valid marriage. But in terms of the sacramental grace that's available, to open that up completely, all right, I would say definitely, and no, any priest could be happy to have you get that off your chest, to get that sin out of the way, and certainly, you know, without knowing all the details, or you having some question, or maybe, you know, I would say it sounds like you weren't sure, or maybe someone told you it wasn't necessary. So, you know, it may not be the same as someone who knowingly, willingly withholds and never confesses a sin. Some people just presume, well, I don't have to worry about that. That's ignorance. But I would say, yes, confess that first chance you get. And if your husband was validly baptized in a different Christian church and then made a confession after you guys were married, you know, I would hope he would have confessed that, you know, he had committed the same sin. But again, get it done. So, I mean, go today or go this Saturday, you know, by all means, because that's what the sacrament's there for. It's to give you that wonderful free flow of grace, okay? It's almost like, you know, when you got a plug drain, okay? It goes slow. You want to open up that channel of grace completely. So by all means, take care of that as soon as you can. I don't think you're in spiritual jeopardy, but I would dare say use the advantage that's available to you to get this grace flowing all the way.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Glenn is up next in Long Island, New York, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Glenn, you're on with Father John Trigilio.
Hey, Father John. Thank you so much for taking my call. So my question is this. Jesus Christ told the disciples that what you bind on earth is bound in heaven, what you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. And then recently Pope Francis wrote in Laudato Si, I believe the way it's pronounced, he writes that animals will join humans in the kingdom of heaven. Eternal life will be shared, a shared experience of awe in which each creature resplendently transfigured will take its rightful place and have something to give those poor men and women who will have been liberated once and for all. That's how the text reads. So does this mean that our pets go to heaven, and when we get there, we'll have them?
Well, I mean, certainly Pope Francis' words are comforting to many people. This was not a De Fide Ex Cathedra pronouncement by Pope Francis, so it's not a dogma. It is a theological speculation, and I've heard this before, not just from Pope Francis, but from other theologians who said it is certainly possible that after the resurrection of the body, when our bodies and souls are reunited, we have a glorified body, Thomas Aquinas speculated that there would be food, good food if you're in heaven, bad food if you're in hell. There'd be food and drink without any of the consequences. So, you know, if you're gluten intolerant, or if you have alcohol problems, that won't exist. Now, that being said, if that's the case, the glorified body doesn't need that, doesn't need the food. We don't need our pets because we have Jesus, we have the beatific vision. But if we could have food in the heaven after the resurrection, we certainly could have our pets restored or recreated. It's just that animals don't have an immortal soul. animals and plants have a soul which is mortal. It dies the moment the animal dies or the moment the plant dies. The soul is the principle of life. Human beings and angels have immortal souls. They never die. But that, again, being the case, if God could give us food and if he could restore our pets afterwards, he could certainly recreate trees and anything that at one time was once alive. But I would definitely say that would be secondary. And I remember I was on with Father Bob Levis many years ago. We were doing Web of Faith, and some lady wrote in, and she said, "Well, if my dog's not going to heaven, I don't want to go either." I said, "Well, that's a little bit drastic. You don't want to go that far." But I've lost a pet, a cat that I had when I first came to my parish, and I was very sad when it happened. I would not be sad if I get to heaven. I hope I do. That I see his face at the resurrection. But it's not something that if it doesn't happen, you're not going to be sad. You're not going to say, "Oh, what happened to my pooch or kitty?" If you see God face to face and you're with all the communion of saints, that's going to be joy enough. However, God's not limited to that, so he certainly can do it. It's not something that's out of necessity. It would be out of his pure free choice.
Another great podcast on EWTN's Podcast Central is Way of the Fathers. Dr. Jim Papandrea brings you a podcast about the fathers and doctors of the church, the foundational figures of Christian history. You can hear Way of the Fathers and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place. Visit EWTN Podcast Central, visit EWTN.com/radio, and click on Podcast Central today. Next up is Sandra, a first-time caller in Dayton, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Sandra, you're on with Father John Trujillo.
Thank you for taking my call. This is related to a previous question. You were talking about the Latin Mass. I have some relatives that have recently started going to the Pius X Church, Catholic, supposed to be. I want to know, what's the difference between the Latin Mass beliefs and the Pius X beliefs?
Okay, well, certainly the Mass would be the same. The Society of Pius X and the Fraternity of St. Peter, they both celebrate the same, which it's sometimes called the Trinitine Latin Mass, or as Pope Benedict called it, the extraordinary form. It's the Mass of prior to Vatican II. It's the exact same Mass, but when the Pius X Society celebrates it, they're not in full union with the Church, because even though they had the excommunication that took place of the bishops who were illicitly but validly, you know, consecrated bishops, Catholics who go to that Mass, it's still considered a valid Mass. And I know some people get concerned or worried which one they go to. I would say it's much better for you to go to the Fraternity of St. Peter if you want to go to the extraordinary form, because they're completely, totally recognized by the Catholic Church, as is the Institute of Christ the High Priest, and I think there's another group out there. But if you go to Pius X or SSPX, as they're sometimes referred to, it's like you're going to a Mass. It's valid, but you're not. You're sort of also endorsing the fracturedness that's taking place in the Church. And we want everything under, you know, because it's the jurisdiction, papal primacy and papal fallibility are two different characteristics that the Pope has, but we want to follow the Pope's jurisdictional authority as well as his teaching authority, and that's why it's good to do submit completely to the authority of the Church, whether it's the magisterium or the hierarchical authority of the Church.
Morgan is next up in the great state of Illinois. She's listening on the Amazon Echo. Morgan, you're on with Father John Trujillo.
Hi. My question concerns the Catholic Church in the field of genetics. I'm really thinking about a career path in that area of science, because my little brother and I have a rare genetic disorder that I'm just a carrier for, but he almost died from several times. He's alive. he had to have 5 surgeries by the time he was 4 and all this. And the problem is there's a lot of sin going on in that field right now, such as altering the genders in the womb or even identifying the unborn's possible health problems, such as Down syndrome, and then aborting them. It's really awful. And I'm a convert, so I don't want to offend God ever again, although, of course, I'm a sinner. And so I guess my question is, can I be a geneticist helping as many people as I can with the possible moral dilemma of being asked to partake in these genetic practices?
Yes, well, I'm so glad you called, and certainly I'll be keeping both of you and your brother in my prayers. I had a brother who had muscular dystrophy. He passed away when he was only 26 as a consequence of that. So I know anybody who's got a disability in any way, shape, or form, the family, you know, carries a heavy cross. And yet, what a blessing those siblings and friends of ours are, despite their trials and tribulations. We need desperately good doctors and nurses and researchers in this field. So I would say, yes, we want people to study, but where you have to draw the line is you yourself cannot materially, formally cooperate in evil by participating. So if you're studying, whether it's to be a geneticist or just to be a gynecologist or a scientist generally speaking, the ends never justifies the means, so you can never directly cause or help cause an abortion or euthanasia, and yet you could still go to a medical school and absent yourself from procedures and say, I cannot do that. If they say, well, you have to, say, no, this is a freedom of religion. You have your right to respect your conscience and the First Amendment, especially in the United States, protects that. So you have good grounding on that. If you contact the Catholic Medical Association, the CMA, they can certainly help you with that.
God bless you, Morgan, and we will keep you in our prayers. Next up is John in the great state of Virginia, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. John, you're on with Father John Trigilio.
Hi, Father John. I'm just trying to understand go deeper into the seven sorrows of Mary devotion. And the first one, the prophecy of Simeon, and I understand the first part was that a sword will pierce your soul, as being that she will participate in the suffering of the redemption. It's the second part that's kind of tricky for me. I'm just trying to understand the wording, that the thoughts of many will be revealed. And I was just wondering if you could help me with that.
Okay, that's an excellent question. I myself have a very strong devotion to Our Lady of Sorrows. The Servite brothers are the ones who promoted this. There's their main shrine in Chicago, Illinois. You can get the Seven Sorrows Chaplet. I even have a statue of Our Lady of Sorrows here on my desk at the seminary. And there's the black scapular that you can wear. As you mentioned, the different sorrows of Mary, when Simeon foretold that a sword will pierce your heart and the hearts of many would be laid bare, because Mary is at the foot of the cross, and sometimes you see a picture in art of the Sacred Heart of Jesus right next to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Jesus has his Sacred Heart with a crown of thorns and a spear of Longinus poking through it. Mary's heart, all right, will typically have a sword piercing her heart. This is an artistic rendition, but it shows that Mary's heart is open just as Jesus's heart was physically open. She is a conduit, again, as an intercessor. She's not, Jesus is the one mediator, but Mary, as a mediatrix, is subservient to Jesus, the one mediator. She is the intercessor par excellence. And so, because she is not, she knows well what suffering is too, although she didn't die on the cross like her son did, a mother watching her only child suffer this horrible death. I remember when my mother had to bury, three of her children. That's something you can never describe. So Mary's empathy and compassion flow from that.
on behalf, well, Father, first of all, would you leave us with a blessing?
Absolutely. Benedica vos omnipotens Deus, Pater, et Filius, et Spiritus Sanctus. Amen.
Amen. Getting ahead of myself there. On behalf of our host, Father John Trujillo, our producer, Michael McCall, call screener, Matt Gubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Ace McKay, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line Monday. We keep things rolling tomorrow with Father Wade Menezes talking faith, family, and fellowship. Until we get together then, God bless.